Thank you for joining us. This is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Fisheries Pod. Through Patreon, you're able to support the show with either a recurring or one-time donation, which helps us pay for various parts of the show. If that isn't your thing, you can also purchase Fisheries Pod shirts, hoodies, stickers, and face masks on our Teespring store if you feel inclined. So check it out. Our guest today is Sasha Pereira. Sasha graduated this past May from North Carolina State University with a bachelor's in zoology and a minor's in applied ecology and environmental education. She's previously worked at NC State's Center for Marine Sciences and Technology, the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission, and the Idaho Power Company. Currently, she's employed as a fisheries technician with the Wyoming Cooperative Fish and Wildlife Research Unit in Jackson, Wyoming. Her research interests are interdisciplinary and include community ecology in aquatic environments, equity in science and environmental education, and environmental justice. Welcome to the podcast, Sasha.
Hi, thanks, Anna. Thanks for having me. It's so nice to see you again.
Of course. I know. This is awesome. I'm excited to hear more about your current research and what you've been up to in Wyoming. It's been fun for me to see your pictures and kind of get a little glimpse into what you're doing out there. But I think before we get into that, it would be great to give listeners a little more detail on your research background. So to start off, what inspired you to get into ecology and specifically fisheries?
So I guess before I get into the questions, I should probably warn you that I do talk a lot. And if you need to cut me off for any reason, that is totally fine.
No, or that's perfect.
If you want to be like passive aggressive about it, you could just like mute me from afar. That's totally fine too. Just so you know.
That is true. I have the power.
Yeah. Anyways, back to your question. So when I was in high school, I remember that I always really liked math and science and being outdoors. But at the time, I was pretty certain that I was going to go to medical school and become a doctor because, you know, that's what everyone wants to do when they're in high school.
Yeah.
And I also didn't really realize that you could actually be an environmental scientist when you, quote unquote, grow up. Mm-hmm. But when I was a junior in high school, I got this internship at Reedy Creek Nature Center, which is in Charlotte, North Carolina. And it actually ended up being my very first job, which was exciting. And a big part of those internship duties involved taking care of all of our wildlife ambassadors at the center. And so that included things like snakes and turtles and beetles and snails. And I remember that we had this one toad that I can only describe as extremely round.
Oh, I love that.
He was great. And I think we had to put him on like a cricket diet or something because he would just literally inhale anything that came into his enclosure. He was living his best life. It was great.
That's very sweet.
Right. And, you know, I just absolutely loved working there. I loved learning about all the native wildlife we have in Central North Carolina, as well as like taking all the snakes out of their enclosures and showing them off to the visitors and helping people overcome their fear of everything that was creepy and crawly. So it was definitely like a dream first job for sure. But when it kind of came time to apply to college when I was a senior, at that point, I had read all of these articles online that said, you know, if you go into an environmental field, you will never be able to find a job or make any money, which to be fair, are still valid points today.
Yeah, I mean, it's a consideration.
Yeah, definitely. But I was like, this is not good for me. And so I ended up coming to NC State as an engineering major because I figured that I could still do like environmental work while also having a job that pays the bills, which is, you know, good. And then I spent like
it's a very pragmatic.
I was a very practical 18-year-old.
Yes.
Yeah. And then, you know, after spending a semester or so in the program, I kind of realized that engineering is very cool in many ways, but it's definitely a lot more fun to just be outside day around in the dirt. Yeah. So it's like maybe engineering is not for me after all. Mm-hmm. But I think that the real, I guess, turning point for me came when I got into this program called the Dorsey Conservation Scholars Program, which is this absolutely incredible opportunity that I could sing praises about for days on end. And the Dorsey program is for underrepresented students who are interested in things like environmental conservation, as well as diversity, equity, inclusivity. And the benefits for the program are just absolutely insane. So not only does it help you find two paid summer research internships, And I should mention that they're really well paid for like an entry-level position, which is pretty important because finances are often a big barrier for students mm-hmm. who want to enter the field.
Yeah, that is a huge deal. I know, yeah. Just thinking about
when I've got paid
in some of my internships versus what you guys get paid for Doris Duke. I was like, ooh, I should have done Doris Duke.
Yeah, it's just such an amazing program. And so in addition to like those internships, it basically gives you like full funding to present an independent research project at a national conference. You also get like tons of mentorship opportunities and like access to this alumni network, and it's great all around. Wow. And so after I completed my first summer in that program, which, you know, coincidentally involved fish, I was like, bye engineering, and I switched to zoology, which is great. And then as for the fisheries component of your question, I should probably say that I have not quite sold my soul to fisheries yet, which I know is probably unpopular to say on this podcast. I think fish are really neat, but I'm still kind of exploring what kinds of research questions and systems that I'm most interested in studying. And I also really like insects. That kind of plays a big part into
very
that as well.
Cool. Yeah, no, yeah. That makes sense. I mean, definitely with fisheries, I feel like it can be a bit of a like an insular community or something like that, or it's cordoned off as this separate thing, but it's all the same. It's very fun questions. There's a lot of interacting with animals, getting in the mud, getting in the ocean, getting in streams. Fish, you know? So yeah, I think it's a, you know, it has the same universal appeal as the rest of ecology. It's just people like to make it a special category.
Yeah, that is true.
Yeah. Well, yeah, thank you for that kind of intro to your background and how you got inspired to pursue this path. I think it's great to hear about kind of what opportunities are out there for people interested in this sort of research. Because I know definitely when I was coming up in this, I had a similar approach where I wanted to find some way to do something sciencey and make money. And then when I found out that you could actually be a researcher and study things like fish or aquatic systems or other animals, it was just absolutely mind-blowing. So it's good for people to know about that stuff. And I guess with that, if you wouldn't mind walking us through maybe a highlight reel of some of your past projects. I know you've done so much, and we could probably talk for, you know, a whole nother hour about that stuff.
But I won't maybe make you just, listen to that, I promise.
Yeah, like the cliff notes of questions you've investigated, species and systems you've worked with, and then any findings, or even, I guess, just stories that you'd like to share about your research.
Yeah, so I guess first I'll just kind of briefly touch on my research interests, which are kind of all over the place at the moment, just FYI. Yeah. But I'm in kind of a weird spot right now because I have interest in both the natural and social sciences. And I'm in the very, very stressful process of trying to figure out if I want to pursue a graduate degree in that traditional ecology field or if I want to do something in like science and environmental education. So who knows what will happen.
Yeah.
But, you know, part of that reason why I am so confused is just because I've had so many cool opportunities to work with amazing people on amazing projects. And so my first field season, which was facilitated through the Doris Duke program, it took place this summer after my freshman year, I think, at the NC State Center for Marine Sciences and Technology, which is in Moorhead City, North Carolina, a place that you are also very familiar with, having worked there yourself.
It's the best. We love CMAST.
We love CMAST. And at the time, I was helping out with this PhD project that was studying how passive acoustic monitoring can be used to assess fish biodiversity on restored oyster reefs. And it was just an all-around incredible experience because I got to learn how to drive a boat and how to deploy gill nets and hydrophones and how to process acoustic data. And I also got to conduct my first independent research project, which was a little scary, but to be able to do that, all of that in like such a warm, welcoming environment made all the difference for sure. I'm actually still really close with my research mentor from that project, even though it was like 5 years ago. And she's
That's amazing.
And she's like one of the first people I go to if I ever need professional advice for something, although she's probably tired of hearing from me at this point. She's like, oh no, another email from Sasha.
That's so funny.
Then the following summer, the summer after my sophomore year, I went to Florida to work with the Fisheries Independent Monitoring Program with the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission, which is a bit of a mouthful, but it's an amazing program. And I think that was my first time living out of state on my own. So So I was a little bit nervous going into it, but you know, Florida is just so beautiful and the biodiversity there is insane. So like, I really couldn't have anything to complain about.
Yeah.
And then when I was with FWC, I would typically go out in the field several times a week to help with biological monitoring surveys in Tampa Bay. And we would often use like trowels and seines. And I'm not sure if you've like pulled a 600 foot seine before, but it's a pretty intense workout. And at the end of the summer, my arms
sounds
were like
it.
Yeah.
I'm sure you were absolutely jacked by the end.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. My arms were so jacked and I was pretty happy about. And I definitely turned into one of those gym bros who would like check themselves out in the mirror every time they walked by. I just admire my biceps from different angles. Yeah, I was having a good time.
That's so great. Perks of field work.
Right. But yeah, and so like in the gears that we were using, we caught everything from like red drum and spotted sea trout to seahorses and sharks, which is awesome. Let's see. And then so the following summer, so this is after my junior year, I kind of switched gears a little bit and I went to work over on the freshwater side. And people keep asking me if I'm like hashtag team salty or team fresh. I don't know. I just do not. I like them both at the moment.
Why not both? Exactly.
Exactly. Yeah.
I know. That's how I feel about it. As someone who grew up in Ohio and is very partial to, you know, like rivers and lakes. And then now I'm in Florida.
Yeah. Like they're both cool. They both have so many interesting features.
Exactly.
But yeah, so that summer I worked out of Boise, Idaho for Idaho Power Company, which kind of specializes in hydroelectric energy production. And that was my first time working in a major river system, which is very cool and different.
Yeah.
And we did a lot of, I guess, field work related to electrofishing for bull trout and these high elevation streams that required us to camp out during the week. And then we also caught white sturgeon in the Snake River itself. And Idaho is a very interesting state. Like, it's definitely underrated. There are just so many amazing mountainous areas to explore.
Yeah, no, I remember just seeing some of your pictures and things from while you were there and thinking, wow, I did not know that's what Idaho looks like. And now I think I want to go to Idaho.
Yes, you should definitely go and you should take me with you.
Yes, especially now. I know, like, I do love Florida, but it's so flat.
Yeah.
I kind of want some elevation in my life. So maybe when things, I don't know, calm down with the pandemic, eventually one day, fingers crossed, we could do a little Idaho adventure.
Yes, road trip. I would love for that to happen.
That'd be fun.
Yeah. Let's say, I think, yeah. So, I mean, I worked on like a few other ecology related projects, but I think those are the main ones, or the ones I spent the most time with at least. And there was one other thing I wanted to mention, but I know I just threw like a ton of information at you. So do you have any follow-up questions before I get into that?
I don't think so. I mean, I think it's cool to see sort of, even on just the ecology side of things, the diversity of systems you've worked with and even the variety of sampling techniques. I think it might help. I'm sure some of the people who listen are familiar with what hydrophones are and, you know, passive acoustic monitoring and things like that. But for those that aren't, could you give just like a brief explanation? I'm sorry to put you on the spot on that one.
No, that's fine. Yeah, no, this is basically my independent research project. So I kind of have an idea of what to say. So there are different kinds of passive acoustic monitoring. But essentially what that means is you deploy like some kind of a receiver in the area that you want to study, and then you leave it alone to like passively record things in the environment. And so hydrophones are referred to like a specific kind of passive acoustic monitoring. It's not necessarily telemetry, but hydrophones are these underwater microphones. And so what we did for that project is we would deploy them on these oyster reefs that had been restored. And so they would record the ambient noise or the soundscape in the area. And then we could later download that data and process it to figure out like which fish have been swimming by this reef or like which ones are using this reef.
That's so cool. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm trying to think of a analogy for what that's similar to. Because I mean, I always try and explain telemetry to people who maybe aren't familiar with it from my past work tracking cobia. And I think it's, you know, it's essentially easy pass. But I wonder if using hydrophones to listen for sounds and characteristic sounds for species and things like that, what I could compare that to. I'll have to put a pin in that one and keep thinking about it.
Yeah. Oh, I guess I should clarify that. So there are sounds that the fish are actually making. So they're like fish calls or fish vocalizations, not necessarily like the ping that a tagged fish would give off if, as it swam by.
Yeah, that's the key difference. That's so cool, though. And I think it's fun to think about that as well, since people maybe, you know, don't think so much as the ocean as being loud.
You're being it's loud, trust me. It's very loud.
There's a lot going on down there.
Yes.
That's awesome. Well, yeah. I may have derailed us a little bit, so we can get back on track, but thank you for explaining that. I think it just helps.
I guess like just the last thing I wanted to mention is that I also have a background in environmental education. I minored in EE, and I'm kind of in the process of completing my North Carolina environmental educator certification, even though I'm no longer in North Carolina.
But yeah, you know,
it's fine.
We're all online anyway. Nothing is real.
Yeah. Yeah, right. But when I was a senior, I started working in the environmental education lab at NC State, which is led by Dr. Catherine Stevenson. And her lab does some like really, really interesting work related to things like youth empowerment and intergenerational learning. And we typically think of intergenerational learning as this process where adults pass on knowledge to children. But her lab actually looks at the opposite of that. And they've had a lot of projects, some of which are still ongoing, some of which have happened in the past, that have looked at how children can actually influence how adults think and behave about environmental topics, which is very cool.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and they found in one of their studies that children can actually change their parents' minds about climate change, which is huge, like such a big finding.
Yeah, that's a major deal.
Yeah, that's pretty big. And that paper actually got published in Nature, which is, you know, how you know it's kind of a big deal.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, and so I've been really fortunate to work with them for about a year now, and I'm excited to continue working with them.
That is incredible. But yeah, I think that's something that got me, you know, particularly excited to get you on the podcast at some point, just because, you know, you have this very interdisciplinary background. And so I think that that's a cool thing to share with people.
Oh, thank you. And I think so too.
It's also, you know, very important.
Yeah.
Because, you know, that's the thing with fisheries, is there's the ecological component, but then, you know, there's the social systems and things that are the other half of that whole picture. So that's awesome. I suppose we can move on to your current research and talk about your work with the Wyoming Cooperative Unit. I'd like to revisit later on to talk about more of your interdisciplinary interests. But yeah, maybe let's just talk about your current work, and then we'll come back to that one.
Yeah, definitely.
Sweet.
Yeah. So I guess currently I'm working as a seasonal fisheries technician for the Wyoming Co-op Unit, which is based out of the University of Wyoming. And I'm helping out with this PhD project that's looking at the role that spring-fed streams play in Snake River cutthroat trout reproduction. And so we're kind of working mostly out of the Jackson Hole area, which is great because it means I get to splash around in a lot of very picturesque streams for work.
Yeah.
So I can't complain.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and it's amazing because we work in streams that are in Grand Teton National Park, some streams that are on Forest Service land, as well as on streams that are on private properties. And those owners are typically very conservation-minded, which is kind of cool.
That's great. Yeah, we love that.
Yeah, we love that, right?
Yeah.
And I guess in terms of like our actual field work, so during like the cutthroat trout spawning period, which was earlier this summer, we had these weirs set up on a couple of streams, and we would just like process any adult cutthroats that came through it. We also did like spawning ground surveys where we would walk around in the stream to try and find reds, which are fish nests. And then once spawning tapered off, we put these traps called red caps over certain reds. And a red cap is basically this like mesh netting stretched over a rebar frame that leads to a bucket. And it kind of looks like a giant horseshoe crab, to be honest.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. But once
That's a great visual.
Right. Yeah, exactly. But once the fry hatch, they kind of swim up through the gravel and then get immediately swept into the bucket. So it's a very ceremonious introduction to life.
Oh, man. That's funny.
Yeah. And so once they're in the bucket, we can kind of process them and, you know, like have a look at how they're doing. The last major, I guess, part of our work has just been doing these like growth and production surveys, where we go to those streams and we try and catch fry using dip nets. And that part has been really cool because you get to watch the little fry grow up and, you know, turn into little footballs, at least the ones that don't get eaten, which unfortunately most of them do get eaten.
Yeah, that is the rough life of a young fish. High mortality.
But yeah, it's been a great experience so far. We have been living in a tent for the last 4 months, so that was definitely an adjustment at first.
Wow.
But just gets you closer to nature, you know?
That is true. You're very close.
Yes, like literally very close.
That's amazing, though.
Yeah, I guess, honestly, I think besides the tent, probably the biggest adjustment for me was just like learning how to work in grizzly country for the first time. Because there was like tons of bears and moose around here. Yeah, so we always carry like bear spray in the field and we make a lot of noise because the last thing you want to do is surprise a bear because that would end badly for you.
That is true. Just bells and periodic screaming and things like that.
Yeah, pretty much.
That does sound like a blast though. And you have an interest kind of in your free time, right?
Yes.
You know, getting outdoors, not for work.
Yeah.
And hiking and camping and whatnot. Have you had a chance to do any of that since you've been out there?
Oh yeah, definitely. Oh gosh, this entire region is just basically like one big outdoor playground. Because not only do we have Grand Teton National Park, basically in our backyard, there's also like Bridger Teton National Forest and Caribou Targhee National Forest and the Teton Wilderness and Gravant Wilderness. And there's just a bunch of forests around us, basically.
Yeah.
So many places to explore. And I've been spending almost all my days off have been spent like hiking and backpacking. But fly fishing is also pretty big around here to go back and fish.
Ooh,
And I finally caught my first fish on the fly this summer after many.
Oh, congratulations. Times.
Thank you. It was kind of funny though, because it was this like little lake trout and I thought it was a rock for the longest time until it started flopping on the bank. And I was like, oh man, this is a feisty rock.
It's really a fish.
Yeah.
It's awesome. Man, I mean, any size fish on the fly is fun, you know?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And getting your first one somewhere that beautiful is amazing. I think mine was in probably a quarry in Ohio or something. Not that that isn't nice, because I do love me some Ohio quarries, but yeah. I think yours is probably better.
Yeah, it was a fun experience. I wish I had realized that it was a fish. I think I would have been more excited in the moment.
Yeah, it's true. It's sort of a delayed impact kind of thing. That's so great, though. Yeah, I guess that is sort of dream fly fishing country where you are. So, well, that's cool. I mean, fish for your work time and fish for your free time is a pretty good deal. So, I think that does well at covering, I guess, what you're up to right now, unless there's anything else you'd like to share. If not, I know we have plenty of things we can talk about. So
yes, indeed. Yeah,
I think this moving.
Yeah, I think I'm good. I'm all talked out at the moment.
Yeah. I appreciate that you like to talk. It makes it easier for me.
Yes. You're welcome.
No complaints here. I guess maybe now is a good time to revisit your passion for equity in science and in education, environmental education. So I was wondering if you could just highlight projects or maybe some past work you've done in those areas.
Yeah, sure. So I guess like outside of just general science, I would say I'm really interested in helping to broaden the participation of historically excluded groups in EEB, which stands for Ecology and Evolutionary Biology. But also just kind of within education in general. And I absolutely love working with kids. It is just like so much fun. I've spent a lot of time working with, I guess, quote unquote, underrepresented and at-risk youth. But the students that I've had the privilege of tutoring and spending time with have just been so brilliant and talented and curious and wonderful. And it's really important to me that they feel like they belong and that their contributions are being valued regardless of whatever career path they end up going into, which is hopefully ecology, but you know, we'll accept other career paths as well. But my honors capstone project is actually focused on college accessibility, and it was like completely unrelated to ecology and fish whatsoever. But for that, I kind of looked at how outreach programs that are run through university honors program can play a role in reducing undermatching among students who identify with historically excluded groups. So undermatching is this phenomenon where students don't apply to schools that are as selective as their credentials and qualifications might warrant, primarily due to things like psychological and emotional barriers to entering college. And so, you know, while there is absolutely nothing wrong with applying to and attending schools that are less selective, we just want to make sure that these students are feeling confident in their abilities and that they know what to expect when they apply to college so that they can make that decision that is best for them, whatever it may be. And so for that project, we actually conducted this big outreach effort where we worked with the TRIO and Talent Search organizations on campus. And they do a lot of work with supporting underrepresented students. And we put on this like demystifying college event for underrepresented high school students. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yes, it definitely was a blast. And I guess like one other quick thing is that I also worked for a year as an instructor for the Catalyst program. Mm-hmm. And that's this like national program that helps high school students with disabilities prepare for a career in STEM. And so throughout the year, I worked on this with my students, but we worked on this group project where the students would interview a scientist with a disability. And then they put together this short video that highlighted the scientist's accomplishments and any advice that the scientists had for students with disabilities who wanted to go into science. And it was really cool. And the students did an amazing job. And I think the videos are supposed to be shared by NASA at some point, which is awesome.
Oh, wow. That's so cool. Well, I guess this also segues us into your article that you published with the Fisheries blog, where you talked about sort of what it's like to be such an avid field researcher, you know, someone who loves to hike to remote locations and be on boats and get covered in mud, but also having to manage a disability. So I was wondering if you could briefly run us through the content of your article, and maybe we can discuss that a little more. And for those listening, I'll include a link to the article with this episode. Highly recommend reading it.
Thank you. Also, I know you said a brief run through, but I have like a small rant prepared. So just
rants
so
are great. I will also
might not
take
be that
a brief.
Awesome. I guess first I should note that, so while I identify as a person with a disability, there are many others in the disability community who prefer to use the term disabled. And so it's a very individualized thing that definitely varies from person to person.
Yeah.
But anyways, back to me. So I was diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis just after I turned one, I think. So RA is this condition where your immune system is overactive and it attacks your joints, which, you know, is not really a great thing.
Yeah.
Apparently like one day, one of my fingers got really swollen and I started limping around and my mom was like, you know, something seems a little off here. Mm-hmm. And so they took me to the doctor and ran some tests and they were like, yeah, she has juvenile rheumatoid arthritis. And I know it sounds weird for an infant to have arthritis, but juvenile arthritis is actually at least as common as juvenile diabetes, potentially more so. I'm not sure the exact statistics, but you know, if it's left untreated, I would most likely get really stiff and sore over time. And so my joints might get swollen and it would just, you know, all around be a very unpleasant situation.
Yeah.
But to try and prevent that, I take immunosuppressant medication, which works pretty well for the most part. It's very rare for me to have a flare that would significantly impact my ability to get around. And unless I am having one of those flares, it's just about impossible to tell that I do have arthritis. So in a sense, it's an invisible disability.
Yeah.
And I didn't have any arthritis-related problems when I was working for CMAST in North Carolina or when I was working with the Florida Fish and Wildlife Commission. And since I didn't really have any issues, it didn't really cross my mind to tell any of my supervisors about it. Mm-hmm. But that was also partly because when I was growing up, and even honestly, throughout the first half of college, I was so worried of what people would think if I told them that I had arthritis that I hid it from pretty much everybody, even my best friends. Yeah, I was like, oh, no.
Yeah, it does, I feel like, you know, probably put you in a bit of a vulnerable place. Be like, oh, by the way.
Yeah, exactly.
This thing about me that might surprise you and make you think differently of me or something. Yeah, especially, you know, if it's people who don't realize, you know, what it is or know much about it, I'm sure, you know.
Yeah, exactly. And especially like, you know, right. Yeah. And when you're young, you just want to be cool and popular. And at the time I was like, how can I be cool if I have arthritis? And obviously now I know they are majorly exclusive, but at the time.
You can be both.
Exactly. Yeah. I definitely went through a phase where I was like, oh my God, people are going to judge me. Yeah. Anyways, so I guess fast forwarding a bit to the summer when I was working for Idaho Power.
Mm-hmm.
So basically kind of the basis for the article is that a few days before I was supposed to start working for Idaho Power, I noticed that there was some swelling in my knee. And it was kind of hard to bend it. It's kind of hard to walk, which typically means that like an arthritis flare is happening. And it was like 2 days before I was supposed to start work. And I was supposed to be going out into the field my first week. And I was like, oh my goodness, what am I going to do? Because I'd never gone through that before. And I remember at the time, I genuinely thought they were going to fire me, which obviously has no logical basis.
Yes, but it's like, you know, there's, I guess there is that worry that something like that could be perceived as, I guess, too big a downside or an obstacle. Like there's a stigma maybe. And that's, from reading your article, I remember you'd gone for like a cross-country road trip leading up to this too, to get out there. So it's like
40 hours drive
to a new place, and then this is happening. So I imagine, I mean, if I was in your shoes, I would be very stressed.
So. Oh yes, that's a good way of describing it for sure. But you know, I had like a day or so to make a decision about what to do. And so I ended up calling my supervisor just to talk about the issue and let them know what was going on. But thankfully he was super understanding, and we were able to work out this plan where I would still be able to go on the boat that first week and help out. But I would just kind of do like less of the heavy lifting while I recovered. I was on data duty for a couple of days.
Yeah.
And then, during the internship, I had this opportunity to do an independent project. And so one of my coworkers suggested that I write an article for the fisheries blog about a topic of my choice. And I, you know, I'd kind of always wanted to get into disability advocacy, but I wasn't really sure what the best way to do it was. Because it's especially kind of nerve-wracking to disclose something like that as someone who's pretty early on in their career, just because once you put something on the internet, it's there forever, which could be a good or bad thing, I guess. And I was just so worried that future employers or graduate advisors might see it and form biases, however you pronounce that, against me. And I think, I actually ended up emailing 18 different people to get their input on whether or not I should write it. So that's how stressed I was about the situation. So the article just kind of gives a run through of how I handled that situation with Idaho Power in a little bit more detail. And then there's some like broader takeaways on how to manage disability when you're working in a career that involves a lot of field work.
Yeah, there's so much in the article, probably more than we can cover here. But I think one thing that stood out to me as someone who's, you know, worked on research teams and also had a variety of different kind of supervisors or different positions in lab groups, I thought your article definitely had some key takeaways that people in those sorts of structures could apply. So I was wondering if you, off the top of your head, had any examples where like a team member or a lab group kind of did well to take your RA into account and I guess provide a situation where, you know, you didn't have to worry about that causing a problem.
Yeah, definitely. So I guess first going back, I guess, to the Idaho Power example, one of the things that I really appreciated was that my supervisor and my coworkers actually believed me when I told them about my abilities and any potential limitations that might be associated with my condition. And they didn't try and form their own like judgments or assumptions about what I was capable of doing. But I think what I appreciate most of all about that situation is that once I'd recovered from my flare, they didn't try and modify any of my like future job activities to make them easier because of the chance that I might have a flare again. But no, they put me to work that summer.
That's great.
It was great. It was, which was exactly what I wanted. And I think, you know, I've proven over the last few years that I am fully capable of doing intensive physical labor in the field. And I don't really want to be given tasks that are considered physically easier just because somebody, you know, wrongly assumes that I can't do the harder stuff because of my condition. So I think, and then I guess more recently, I actually called my current supervisor, Jeff Baldock, before starting this job to talk about my arthritis and what it might entail in terms of how it could potentially affect my work performance. And we also kind of talked about some options for how we could modify my work responsibilities if that were to come up. And thankfully, he was very supportive, and he actually helped facilitate a conversation between the two of us in HR, just so that everybody was kind of on the same page in terms of what to expect. And so even though I didn't really need to request formal accommodations because we figured that we could just work it out between the two of us, it was still really nice to have somebody in my corner who could advocate for me if needed.
Yeah, no, that's amazing. I mean, I think it's just probably so huge to have someone who can help out with finding those pathways, I guess, and then setting up contingencies ahead of time.
Right, exactly.
I was thinking about that. This is like kind of a silly example, but trying to brainstorm other ways that this could apply more generally to just working in teams in science. And I thought of the example where it's, you know, you're working with maybe an all male or mostly male research team, and you're the one woman, you have to figure out when and where to pee.
Yes. Oh my gosh. That's such a good example.
And I think, you know, things like that, it's just so much better if it's the other group members have this expectation that they're going to confront items like that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, without any weirdness around it. So everyone's on the same page. I think that's really cool.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I was also curious, I guess, whether you have any suggestions kind of from this experience or other experiences for how people in leadership or supervisory positions can be better about equity and being more equitable in how they execute their job.
I think that it would be helpful for anyone in like a supervisory or managerial role to familiarize themselves with the Americans with Disabilities Act. Mm-hmm. Like, you definitely don't need to read the whole thing, because I also have not read the whole thing.
Yeah.
I don't plan to. Yeah. But it's, you know, it's useful to have like a general understanding of what it entails. And if you have any questions, there's like a ton of information online about it. And someone in your HR, like in an organization's HR department, is typically pretty knowledgeable about that. So you could also go to them for if you have any questions. And then it might also be worthwhile to talk to HR about like hiring policies and how you can better support applicants with disabilities. Because just for the record, it is illegal to ask if someone has a disability during a job interview. But I discovered that the way that employers like to get around that rule is by listing things in the job description like, must be able to lift 50 pounds as an essential job function.
Yeah, that's a classic.
Yes.
I've seen that one.
Right. And like, I'm, you know, I'm finishing up my fourth field season now, and I don't think I've like ever had to lift 50 pounds in any kind of jobs,
yeah, that's actually true.
And yet, like, you see that all the time on ecology job postings. And I'm sure there are some jobs that actually do need you to be able to do that, but the majority of them don't. And so when I see that on a posting, I'm like, it kind of makes it sound like the employer is looking to exclude a certain kind of applicant. But, you know, it's just not a good look overall.
Yeah, no, that is interesting. I guess, like, having gone through application processes plenty of times, I've always come across that one. And I guess I didn't think too hard about it, but it always seemed a little strange.
Yeah, they're very sneaky with how they slide it in there. Let's see. Oh, I guess, so this one's kind of, like, obvious, I guess. But, you know, having basic compassion is very important. I like to think that I'm the kind of person who, you know, turns to humor in stressful situations, and that I hopefully don't get too crotchety. But, you know, sometimes like in society, there's kind of this expectation that, you know, if you're in pain or if you're struggling in some way, that you should try and hide it so that you don't make other people uncomfortable. And based on something that's happened to me personally, I can say that I think most people would find it frustrating to go from, you know, being able to hike over 20 miles in a single day to being barely able to walk a few days later. So while you definitely like shouldn't look down upon somebody who's going through a hard time, ignoring it isn't really the best option either.
Yeah, I guess. That is true.
Yeah. And I should note that I am very, very new to disability rights activism. But there are so many scholars and activists who have been doing this work for years. And I actually came across this really interesting article lately that was talking about how some disability advocates are calling for an end to the use of the phrase able-bodied, because technically, like, everyone's body just naturally deteriorates over time. So can anyone actually be considered able-bodied? So that's just some food for thought.
That is a good point. Yeah. I feel as though people exist sort of on a spectrum of abilities in different areas, and there's no one way to be able-bodied or otherwise, you know?
Yeah, it's definitely not binary at all.
For instance, if someone wanted to get something from a high shelf, I'm great for that because I'm tall. But if they want something down low, good luck. Man. But yeah, that is really interesting. I'd love to read up on that more. If you can find the title, maybe I can include that in the episode link too.
Yes, I will be searching
to some resources. Because more reading is always good.
Yes, for sure.
So now the tough part of the interview is over, and we're down to our final five questions that we ask every guest. So the first one is, what is your favorite fish?
Ooh, okay. So my favorite fish at the moment is the hairy frogfish, which I thought you might appreciate given our mutual enthusiasm for frogs, you know?
Yes.
Do you know what like a minion is? Like the little yellow bean thing? Do you know what an evil minion is?
No, but I'll Google that.
Okay. Right, if you Google that, that's basically what a hairy frogfish looks like.
Let's see. Evil minion. Yeah. Oh wow. Yeah, okay. I have seen that.
Yes.
I just Googled the hairy frogfish and you're right. That's exactly
Yeah, you know, frogfish,
they're
that's
just so funny.
They're just so funky. Like they have these little modified pectoral fins that allow them to just waddle around the sea floor, like ambushing prey. Ah, they're great. I love them.
Oh, this is such a good favorite fish. I'm going to get sucked into Google Images. Okay, bringing it back. That is so neat. Well, you've opened my eyes to something today.
You're welcome.
I feel like I am the same way too. Like you said, your favorite fish of the moment. It's hard to have one. Mm-hmm. It's your permanent
There's always something weird that comes along, you know?
Yep. One minute you think you've decided, and the next minute you see a hairy frog thing.
Exactly.
That is incredible. Okay. Well, I will undistract myself. and we can move on to the second question. So what is your favorite memory from your career so far? That's a tough one.
Okay, so unsurprisingly, my answer to this question does involve mud. So this is from, oh gosh, when was this? This is from my first field season, I think, when I was working at CMAST. I was out in this like marshy area with one of my friends who's also an intern. We were collecting bait using hand trawls, which you kind of just like drag around in the mud to try and pick up small shrimp and small fish and things like that. We did that for a couple hours, and by the end of it, I was, you know, pretty muddy. And then for whatever reason, I just decided to smear like mud all over my body. there are definitely pictures of that day on the internet somewhere. And you know, we got some like weird looks from people fishing next to us, but there's just something about turning yourself into a swamp creature that just takes fieldwork to the next level.
That is true. Fully embracing the experience.
Yes, right. Yeah, I'm also pretty sure that I got yelled at for getting mud in the truck afterwards, which is like a not so great part of the memory. But as you know, I decided to recreate that scene for my graduation pictures this year. Mm-hmm. And so I went back to that exact same marshy spot. And then I had my friend like artfully splatter mud on me when I was standing in the water with my cap and gown on.
Yeah, I think we're featuring for the episode one of your incredible graduation posts.
Probably. So I'm sure
I'm excited for everyone to see. I don't think it's the mud one. I'm pretty sure it's the fish costume.
Probably the fish, yeah. That's a good one too. Yeah.
Pure icon, really.
Thank you. Well, it was funny because like I told my mom that I was going to the coast to take my graduation pictures, and she was like, are these going to be normal pictures?
And it's like, decidedly like, not.
Well, yeah.
But it's more fun this way.
Exactly.
I know. I'm inspired by them. I just want to go, you know, run around in a fish costume now.
Hey, you're more than welcome to join me. I will buy you your fish costume.
It is almost Halloween, so have to take that into account. Well, sweet. That sounds like a great memory to me. I also love getting dirty in the field. So I think that, you know, holds a special place in people's hearts.
Yes, very fun.
To enjoy getting out there. I guess we can segue into what is your dream job and or location to do said job?
Oh gosh. Okay. I don't know if this is my dream job necessarily, because I don't really have any idea what that is at the moment.
Yeah.
But a lot of
interests.
Right. Yeah. But I do think that it would be really fun to be like the education director at a biological field station. Because I really love teaching and mentoring, and to have all those resources that come with being based at a research hub, that could lead to some pretty cool like place-based curriculum development opportunities. Mm-hmm. So I think that would be fun. In terms of the location, I know you asked for one, but I have like three. I'm sorry.
That is fun. I'll take it. We love bonus stuff.
Let's see. I've always wanted to explore the coast of British Columbia, Canada. But I also want to work in New Zealand at some point because I have family there.
That's so cool.
I know, yeah, it's great having cousins in like random places around the world.
Yeah, that no, that's awesome.
But I will say that my like absolute all-time favorite place is Pisgah National Forest in Western North Carolina. Because, you know, it might not have those like same majestic rugged mountains that you find out west, but it does have the Blue Ridge Parkway, which is one of the most beautiful places in the world in the fall. Yeah, highly recommend.
Those all sound like good options.
I could be anywhere there. I would be happy.
Yeah, let me know when you go to all of those and I'll visit.
Sounds like a plan.
And that question sort of rolls into our next one. It's if money was no issue and you could do whatever the heck you wanted, what is one project that you would like to work on?
Okay. So I think there's like a pretty big need to try and integrate environmental justice education into like traditional ecology curricula. Because, you know, like as like scientists, it's pretty common for us to try and isolate a system in order to study it. But unfortunately, that often results in us like overlooking the these like broader connections that exist between ecosystem health and human health, especially when we talk about like vulnerable communities. So I think it could be interesting to work on a project that involves making ecology curricula more holistic. By like incorporating elements of social justice. I got a grant my final semester of college to develop this environmental justice lesson plan for the Department of Applied Ecology at NC State. And I chose to focus it on like concentrated animal feeding operations, which are also called CAFOs. And I created a couple of activities that really just tried to highlight how connected the human and natural worlds are. And hopefully I will be able to publish some of those as like publicly available teaching resources, but we will see how that goes.
That's awesome. People should stay on the lookout for that. That's so cool. Yeah, but I think that is a great point. I know I'm taking this philosophy of science course right now, and the most recent discussion we had got into a lot how the traditional sort of, I guess, almost like Western idea of what science is very, very reductionist, and it tends to ignore kind of the greater connections of our work sometimes. So I think maybe bringing back that more holistic perspective to things is a huge deal.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, honestly, to be honest, philosophy usually makes my head hurt, but that sounds like an interesting class. I would take
It makes my head hurt too. Like it's good, but man. Yeah, that's amazing. I'll be excited to hear about, you know, how that goes. And once you get that out there, that's so great.
Yeah, thank you.
We have reached our final question, sadly, because I'm enjoying this, but if you had one point or principle that you could just automatically have programmed into everybody's head, what would that point or principle be?
I wish that more people understood that, or at least in the United States, that accommodations are a right and not a privilege, thanks to the Americans with Disabilities Act. And, you know, I personally have not needed formal accommodations so far in my career, but there are plenty of people who do, and needing accommodations has absolutely nothing to do with your work ethic or your professional qualifications. Using them just puts you kind of on the same footing with everyone else, that you're able to do the job that you were hired to do. And if anyone ever makes you feel bad about needing accommodations, you should send me an email and I will write an angry letter on your behalf. And also maybe glare at them and shake my fist in rage.
Yes.
Very
and we can
stuff,
send them some reading links too.
Exactly.
Here's your homework. Yeah. Well, that is an excellent point. And hopefully, you know, with the work you're doing and maybe this podcast will have a little impact. And
fingers crossed.
Everyone else out there who's working to change people's perceptions, I guess, how to approach equity in our workplace and any other workplace. It's exciting, but yeah, the change.
Yes, exciting, but
it's a long time coming. Yeah. Well, I guess that sums up our interview. I don't have any other questions for you. But thank you so much, Sasha, for coming on the podcast today. I had an absolute blast hearing about what you're working on, what you've been up to, and what you're looking ahead to. You know, it's awesome. Great work.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
If you would like to find out more information or get a hold of Sasha, you can reach her by email at spe reir at ncsu.edu. Or on Twitter and Instagram at Sasha_Piranha. If you would like to get a hold of me or the other hosts, you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram at FisheriesPod, or by old-fashioned email, feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. You can download past, present, and future episodes on your favorite listening app or stream them from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. And don't forget, you can help support the podcast with a monthly contribution through Patreon or by rocking some awesome Fisheries Podcast logo shirts, hoodies, and stickers available on Teespring. I'm Hannah. Thank you for listening to the 142nd episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember, accommodations aren't privileges. They're about putting people on equal footing.